Mr. Finger, you look ready to proceed.
I am, Your Honor. Thank you. Good afternoon. May it please the court. I'm here on behalf of David and Susan R. Day, the defendants below. At the outset, I've advised the clerk's office that I'm asking the court to allow me to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. In this appeal, the R. Days asked the court to determine whether the decision of the trial court to deny attorney's fees in connection with their defense of the slap suit brought by Mr. Nichols was in accordance with the provisions of the statute which allows attorney's fees under such types of suits. In other attorney's fees cases in this court, the court has said it must find a decision denying fees to be arbitrary to overturn it. And it has, in cases, defined arbitrary as being either without reasons or with reasoning that is flawed or contrary to the purposes of the statute. I respectfully suggest that all three factors are present here. The statute that provides for attorney's fees here has two different tests for fees. The first test is whether a suit was commenced without a substantial basis in fact or law, or without a substantial ground for the extension, modification, or reversal of existing law. By its language, the statute does not require a finding of frivolousness, nor is it dependent upon a finding of bad faith, although I would suggest that there is a basis for finding bad faith litigation here. The term commenced suggests that the analysis should be based on a review of the complaint, and in the standard case, traditional case, that's how it will happen. The court will decide a motion to dismiss.
Oh, Mr. Finger, before you go any further, just so the court understands where you're heading, it's your contention, I think, that this was a slap suit, but the Court of Chancery never made that determination. So it seems that your first argument is to support the proposition that this was a slap suit, and then the argument that would follow on that is, and therefore, you were entitled to attorney's fees.
That's correct, Your Honor. The Court of Chancery did not make any specific or explicit determination that this was or was not a slap suit.
It did seem to suggest that although this type of conduct, speaking in a public forum, might give rise to a slap suit, that because of the underlying contractual nature and family relationships that were going on, this might have looked like a slap suit, but it really wasn't.
And that, I respectfully suggest, was error in that the statute sets forth the affirmative requirements for a slap suit. The core of that is petitioning activity. The cause of action arose from the R. Days speaking before the Historic Review Board. And that was the basis for the complaint, the basis for the lawsuit. It doesn't matter. The cases hold in other jurisdictions. Obviously, this is a matter of first impression for this court. But in other jurisdictions, they say it doesn't matter the nature of the cause of action or the surrounding facts. You have to focus on whether it was based upon petitioning activity. And I believe I cited a case in my reply brief to Your Honors, the King case from California, where it was a very similar factual setting without the agency. The developer purchased land from the sellers and required the sellers to go before the regulatory agency and get approval. The sellers went before the agency and got approval, but not the approval that the developer had agreed upon. They got a different type of approval that they wanted instead. The developer sued. The California court said they did this in the context of petitioning activity, and therefore it is under the slap statute. The court then went found out that notwithstanding it was in the slap suit, the facts of the case demonstrated a likelihood of success on the breach of contract claim, which we say is different from this case. But it is not I respectfully suggest it is not the facts or the cause of action. It is whether the claim derives from the defendant's actions in seeking the petitioning government. So I don't think that you can say that it is not a slap suit here. It is a slap suit.
Mr. Finger, yes. If it were clear beyond dispute at the outset that the R. Days were taking positions before the Historical Review Board without having any connection at all to Mrs. R. Days' mother, Mrs. Lewis, that would be one thing. That is, that would be an easier case. Isn't that correct?
I think that if we look at it from the way it occurred,
Your Honor. Yes or no?
No, Your Honor. I'm having a little difficulty with the question. Because
if the R. Days were basically petitioning or taking positions before the Historical Review Board in their capacity as private citizens, totally separate and apart from the contract to sell the property to the developer, then the lawsuit against them would much more easily be characterized as a slap suit. Isn't that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. It would be if there was no connection between the RDAs and the sellers.
Or if it were evident, clearly evident, that there were no connection. Well, but in this case, that wasn't clearly evident, at least at the start. Isn't that correct?
No, Your Honor, it was clearly evident because there was no reference. When the RDAs spoke at the HRB hearing, they did not invoke her mother's name. They did not invoke a connection. I think they invoked a connection to Mrs. Barczewski as being Mrs. RDA being the granddaughter.
Well, before you get too wound up,
yeah.
Are you saying that the Court of Chancery erred by not determining on the face of the complaint?
Yes.
That there was liability or that there should have been a remedy under SLAPP?
Yes, Your Honor. We're suggesting that the notwithstanding the facts, there were absolute legal defenses to the complaint, specifically that they were not liable for the contract because they were not parties to the contract. If you assume that they were agents under the law, agents are not liable for their principal's contract. Tortious interference, there was no allegation of wrongful conduct. And
so you're saying that the Court of Chancery, A, had and was obligated under the SLAPP statute to determine the merits of this matter on a motion, basically from the face of the complaint. And secondly, it erred in, I guess, as a corollary, in determining that there should be some discovery record before addressing the issue.
That's correct, Your Honor. A motion to dismiss, 12b-6. Of course, in any lawsuit, we suggest a litigant has a right to.
Is there any language in the statute that compels the result you're arguing for?
There is nothing in the statute which, A, compels a motion to dismiss. The question I have before the court is whether a litigant is entitled, if they file a good faith motion to dismiss, to have that decided. I looked in the case law.
The court said, no, you're not entitled to have it decided because there is a family connection here, and it's at least inferable. May not be the case, but it's inferable that Mrs. Arday is speaking for her mother, and perhaps with her mother's knowledge. I'm entitled to have a factual record on that. What's wrong with doing that?
Well, the court made that conclusion not based on the allegations of the complaint. If he looked at the allegation of the complaint, and even if there was that inference, Your Honor, we suggest that there were still legal defenses that were absolute to that.
Well, do you agree with the position taken by the ACLU in their amicus brief?
I agree that as a matter of policy, Your Honor, these things should be decided quickly, yes. We encouraged the court to hear this on an expedited basis. The court originally, before my clients were impleaded, stated that he was going to have an expedited trial. We believe that the purpose of this slap suit is to have these things decided quickly so that people who are brought into cases where there is no substantial merit are not subjected to the Hobson's choice of paying lawyers a lot of money or sacrificing their constitutional rights.
Did you submit a stipulation that included a schedule for the court?
We submitted a stipulation after the court said, I'm not going to set an expedited schedule. You do it when you're ready. We had constant discussions with the plaintiff's counsel. When are we going to get a stipulation? When are we going to get a stipulation? We got nothing until we'd filed a motion several months later with the court saying, Your Honor, we've not gotten a stipulation. The next day said, okay, here's
a
stipulation.
Shouldn't you be saying we've attempted to agree, we cannot agree, we move for the following order to be entered? Did you ever do that?
We filed a motion asking for an order to be entered for a schedule, yes. And as a result of that, then we got a stipulation from the plaintiffs.
To which you agreed.
To which we agreed, Your Honor. We were not in a position to argue. The court was quite clear, quite adamantly clear, that it was going to, it was not going to do anything until the plaintiffs got what they wanted discovery-wise.
Well, let's just focus on a couple of points based on the court's questions. And that's why I referred to the ACLU brief. It seems that your position is anyone looking at this complaint should have been able to determine it was a slap suit, made that determination, moved forward on an expedited basis, and awarded attorney's fees. And the problem here is that the Court of Chancery didn't recognize it for what it was, and instead of expediting it, permitted discovery, and then decided it on summary judgment.
Precisely, Your Honor. We suggest, at least as we tried to explain to the Vice Chancellor below, the complaint stated that it was in context with petitioning activity, and the actions of the defendants, the RDAs, were specifically designed to challenge the permitting process. That brought it within the scope of the SLAPP suit. And it also brought it in the scope of the Knorr-Pennington Doctrine, which provides absolute immunity for tort claims and in some cases breach of contract claims for petitioning activity as well. There was no allegation of agency, no allegation of the facts that the Vice Chancellor had ruled in another case and Vice Chancellor Lamb in another case had said have to be in a complaint to allege agency. Therefore, I'm sorry.
In addition, your answer to Justice Holland's question is yes, and I think it was to mine too, that this case should have been seen from the face of the complaint, should have been viewed as a SLAPP suit, and judgment should have been entered, including attorney's fees at the pleading stage. But you take you have an additional position, do you not? And that is that apart from whether or not the SLAPP suit or the SLAPP determination should have been made at the pleading stage, at the very least at the end of the day, after the matter had been considered on summary judgment, the court should have determined that this was a SLAPP suit and that the suit was either brought or continued or both without a substantial basis in fact and law.
That's exactly right, Justice Jacobs. The statute may not entitle us to attorney's fees in every case, but I think it entitles a defendant the right to have those two determinations made.
Okay. Now, for us to agree with your position based on the factual record, we would have to conclude that the suit was either brought or was continued without substantial basis in fact and law. What exactly did the Court of Chancery rule on that issue?
Thank you, Your Honor. The Court of Chancery, if we attached the oral ruling to our brief, and at page 104 of the transcript, he found that there was no rational basis to find breach of contract. Rational basis was the court's term, not mine. At pages 100 and 103, he said there was no rational basis to find causation. At page 104, he said there was no rational basis to find damages. He said there was no evidence of any collusion between Mrs. Lewis and Mrs. Arday, and indeed, plaintiff's counsel conceded that fact. And the court also found there was no confidential information that to be misused. So there's nothing to suggest that Mrs. Arday misused confidential information to the detriment of the debtor.
Now, I have a question, Mr. Finger, but before I ask the question, remind me, what were the costs that were awarded to your client?
The costs that were awarded were basically the electronic filing fees and the fees for a computer expert to observe the harvesting of data from their home computers.
And what was that total?
I'm sorry, I don't have that. I think it was like around $1,500.
But
total.
Not attorney's fees?
No, there were no attorney's fees in there.
Right. And didn't the Vice Chancellor in his oral ruling where he was talking about familial relationships, his status as a son-in-law and things like that, say that although he concluded there was no basis for anything that you've just listed, it wasn't apparent in the beginning that that's the way it would turn out?
Well, the problem with that, Your Honor, is that, again, he never looked at the complaint for commencement.
But he did say that, didn't he?
He said that because of his understanding of familial relationships, he thought there could be something there.
Okay.
However, I would like to add to that.
But he went beyond that. He also talked about the fact that your client was a conduit, for want of a better term, between Mrs. Lewis and her attorney, and did some other things that would show a cooperative relationship.
He did add that. A couple of responses to that. Again, it doesn't. There was nothing about that in the complaint at commencement. There was nothing about that. And moreover, as we point out in our response to the cross appeal, my argument is that none of these things creates an agency relationship. Doing a favor for your mother, passing along documents, does not then impose, we respectfully submit, the legal strictures and responsibilities of an agent. And nor does it, and in any event, even if one assumes that there was an agency, even if you give the benefit of that inference, the law is clear that not everything an agent does is for the principal.
Well, the court found there was a limited agency.
Yes, we will agree that there was a limited agency.
To be a communicator.
Right, to pass along documents from Mr. McCollum.
All right, and you're not challenging that conclusion, are you?
No, Your Honor. What we're saying is that both under Delaware law, the Arthur Jordan case we cited, and other cases.
She wasn't a general agent. She was her mother's limited agent because of, you know, the
that's right. And there's
and the need to have somebody be able to communicate to the attorney her mother's position. Is it your position, and I'm now going back to for putting aside what the court should or should not have done at the pleading stage, but at the end of the case, having made all of the findings that it did in summary judgment, is it your position that based on those findings, the court as a matter of law was obligated to award attorney's fees based on the evidentiary record that had been developed?
I have two positions on that, Your Honor, and my time is running out, so I'll try to be very brief. I would ask the court to analogize the SLAPP statute on attorney's fees to the federal civil rights statute on attorney's fees. It uses discretionary language, but the Supreme Court of the United States has said that because of the purpose of the statute to protect civil rights, a prevailing party, if the plaintiff is the prevailing party, there is a presumption in favor of attorney's fees, which can only be overcome by exceptional circumstances. However, if the court is not prepared to go that far, I would suggest that in this case, there were circumstances that require reversal here that we've described as failure to take action.
Let me interrupt you,
sure.
If you don't mind.
Please.
Section 8138A1 sets forth the standard for awarding attorney's fees. That standard, you have got to show as a matter of law that standard has been satisfied and that therefore the Vice Chancellor erred in not awarding attorney's fees.
Correct.
All I'm asking you is, how do you contend that standard is satisfied in this case? Based on what?
Well, as Your Honor asked me before, what would the record show? And I made several references to finding saying there's no rational basis for his claims. And I respectfully submit if there's no rational basis, there can be no substantial basis.
So you're saying that the court's findings themselves required the entry of an award.
Yes,
of attorney's fees under the statute. Is that your position?
I have to be candid with the court. The statute says may, and the court could easily find that may is a discretionary term, and that is why I made the reference to the civil rights statute.
Mr. Finger, you have about 2.5 minutes of the time you reserved. Do you want to save that?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. I will leave my jurisdictional discussions to the papers. Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Michael Bonkowski for Mr. Nichols, the appellee cross appellant. With the permission of the court, I'd like to introduce Patrick Riley, who has not yet had the pleasure of appearing before you all, and it's my pleasure to have him with me. Mr. Finger has left the jurisdictional and personal and subject matter jurisdiction issues to the papers, and I will do the same unless you have a specific question. My comments on the SLAPP issue are very brief. First off, the Vice Chancellor said at every opportunity that our days were not, in his view, I don't know if he used the term classic, I think at least one time he did, classic SLAPP victims. He said that in the first conference that the Ardays were implicated in. He said it every time that the issue was raised thereafter.
And are there citations to the record in your brief that would enable us to find a definitive ruling that this is not a SLAPP suit?
I don't know that there's a definitive ruling saying this is not a SLAPP suit. There is a statement by the court at the end of the bench ruling where Vice Chancellor Strine specifically said, how else was Mr. Nichols to determine the source of the Arday's comments and the nature of the comments, i.e. whether they were
right, but I
purely
think
SLAPP or purely contract?
If you look at the context of that bench ruling, it could also be construed as an explanation that his suit wasn't frivolous or he had a legitimate reason to suspect something even though it never materialized, which is different than saying this wasn't a SLAPP suit in the first place.
Well, I think that I don't disagree with that. I think the transcript is difficult to get your hands around for a number of reasons. But at the same time, he makes it clear throughout the transcript, I believe, that there were good faith bases to link the Ardays to their to Mrs. Lewis, and that that took them beyond the SLAPP statute.
Well, doesn't he only really say there's no grounds for fee shifting in this case, and without explaining why?
Well, I think he tried to explain. I don't know how clearly it came across. I think he tried to explain why at the end of the transcript.
There are only two reasons that would suffice legally. One is that the SLAPP statute doesn't apply because this is not a SLAPP case, or the SLAPP statute does apply, but the criteria under the statute for awarding attorney's fees have not been satisfied. Which is it? That is, what did the court decide of those two alternatives?
I believe the court decided that this was either commenced in good faith or for a reasonable extension of the law. I think the court concluded, and I can see.
But how does that respond to the question?
Well, the question is, either you are a SLAPP plaintiff. I turned it around and put it on Mr. Nichols. Either you brought this action without a good faith basis under the law, or you contended it without a good faith basis under the law. And the court said Mr. Nichols had a good faith basis to believe that the Ardays were not classic SLAPP litigants and they were outside the statute, and therefore I'm not going to award fees. So that's how I respond.
Outside the statute?
Yes, sir.
And where's the citation to the record where we would find him saying they were outside the statute?
Well, he doesn't use that phrase, I don't believe. I think Your Honor is correct. I think all he says is that Mr. Nichols had the right to chase this issue. How else would he really get to the bottom of the relationship? And that's why the statute in Delaware doesn't foreclose discovery, which the amicus pointed out in its brief.
So how are we going to decide this case? Are we going to say this was not a SLAPP suit, or it was a SLAPP suit and a fee should not have been awarded? Or, as Justice Jacobs said, you know, tell us what the court ruled that you would like us to affirm. Would you like us to affirm a finding that this was not a SLAPP suit?
Yes.
And so you need to tell us in the record where the court made that determination.
Well, I agree that I think that the transcript is not clear on that point. But the court paused on the connection between Mrs. Arday and David Arday and Mrs. Lewis at all times in their representations before the HRB and the county government and the emails, and that's what made it different. That's why His Honor said they are not classic SLAPP plaintiffs.
The problem with that, at least as I see it, is that while there may have been good reason to suspect that there was a connection, that is some agency connection between the Ardays and Mrs. Lewis, before the record had been developed in discovery, after the record was developed, given what the court found, one could easily conclude that the court that there was no connection, and the court so found. And if that's the case, then on what basis would the court be able to conclude that this wasn't a SLAPP suit, or that the SLAPP suit criteria for awarding attorney's fees weren't satisfied?
I appreciate the conundrum, perhaps, that I've presented, but it seems to me that the Vice Chancellor Strine said, you have the opportunity to take discovery on this. How else are you going to find out who's really behind the statements?
Right. My question.
I appreciate
you,
Your Honor.
Let's go back to the end of the day.
Agreed. And so we go forward after having taken the discovery. Whatever the ultimate conclusion may have been in terms of a factual determination of agency, which is one struggles with under the record, transcript.
That's the other problem in this case when you look at the procedural posture. Your client filed multiple amended complaints.
Yes, sir.
And you're talking about factual determination. And this was disposed of on summary judgment. Do you agree that there were no material disputes of fact?
Absolutely not. And I will. I hesitate to abandon the one question. I think there are staggering questions of fact that are in this record, and I will come to them in a second if I may. But my point was going to be, Justice Jacobs, that it seems to me that what the ultimate determination of agency may have been is less important to this issue in the statute than whether there was a good faith basis to believe that they were not SLAPP litigants when you pursued the litigation. And so Vice Chancellor Strine, I think, tacitly in the beginning and expressly later on said, I don't think you're classic SLAPP victims or litigants, and I'm not going to do this. But to come to the questions of fact, we've cross-appealed on the agency issue and the summary judgment. This is a summary judgment case.
You're talking about the summary judgment about the breach of contract.
Yes, sir. This is a summary judgment disposition, and that implicates the slap issues and everything else, but it's a summary judgment case, and one cannot ignore the myriad emails that are out there in this record, most of which link the Ardaes and Mrs. Lewis, and sometimes Mrs. Barczewski. So the Ardaes never made a point of saying, we're not connected to Mrs. Lewis in this chase. They made a point of saying at all times, we are linked to my mother. And I think that, in and of itself, is evidence of why this is not a slap case. But
well,
more to the agency issue.
In legal terms, why? Explain that.
Well, I think you're asking me, why is this an agency case? And we have...
In other words, you're saying that there is enough evidence from the emails and perhaps from other statements to show that the Ardaes were acting as a full agent.
Yes, sir.
Of Mrs. Lewis and therefore were basically aiding and abetting a breach of contract.
That's exactly what I'm saying in my papers, and I'll try and do it this way. The chronology of the contract, for example, Mrs. Lewis signs it on or about February 3. On January 28th or thereabouts, Susan Ardaes sends an email to Mrs. Lewis's attorney saying, I don't want my mother to be required to support post-closing events. Now, that's before Mrs. Lewis signed the contract.
That was the email to Don Iskin.
I don't think so, but it is cited in our reply brief in the issue, the last section of the brief, Your Honor.
Okay.
But it goes right to the cooperation clause. Now, Vice Chancellor Strine said at one point in the transcript, this case is about the cooperation clause. So Mrs. Ardaes is, before the contract is struck, negotiating to preserve the right to attack or oppose the development issues post-closing. The contract is signed. The cooperation clause went into the closing, into the agreement, unmodified. The Ardaes began, or had already begun, I don't recall, but they then turned their energies to fighting amendments to the contract and then to the governing bodies coming to the state, the emails, et cetera, many of which said, my mother is vigorously opposed to this development. On March 14, this is in the same year, this is in 05, counsel for the Barczewski brothers sends a letter to Mrs. Lewis and to Susan Ardaes and says, if you do not stop misrepresenting and interfering, you and your daughter, they were both provided with a letter, you're going to be the subject of substantial legal action. Now, the record is clear, respectfully, that everybody knew Mrs. Ardaes had strong feelings in opposition to the development. That is not a secret. I don't agree that Ms. Ardaes was a limited agent or an interlocutor or an intermeddler, because she was definitely given authority by her mother, as Mr. McCullum testified, to interact in the negotiation of the contract with him. So we start from the premise that she's already got a substantive role, that is, Susan does. And from that point forward,
to the extent the court found otherwise, that was error. You're claiming error.
Absolutely. Right?
That is,
especially at the summary judgment,
the court should have found that she was a full agent of her mother and, in effect, was carrying out her mother's wishes to defeat the contract.
Well, the last part of that is the very interesting question, Your Honor.
Well, maybe
was this really collusion? That word is in the transcript. Was this really conspiracy?
I thought your position was that you created a material issue of fact and that you couldn't decide this on a paper record.
What happens is, after the contract is struck, after Ms. Ardaes acknowledges notice of the implications of the cooperation clause, she continues or begins this campaign of opposition. Mr. Ferry puts them on notice that they better stop it, and they do nothing.
Well, let's go back to the procedural posture, though. In this case, the Court of Chancery, based on what you presented, concluded there was a limited agency. Is that correct?
I think the term used was interlocutor, and I don't know what that means.
We'll use that term. your point is, to the extent the court suggested there was a relationship between mother and daughter, that it's something that should have been pursued and not decided on summary judgment.
That's my position. I don't see how the Vice Chancellor said at one point, is this not, Mr. Finger was asked about, asked a question about why does Mrs. Arday constantly link her statements to her mother? And Mr. Finger made a statement about he was working within the family dynamic. And the Vice Chancellor said, is that not a question of fact as to authorization? And I think that is exactly what it is. What you then have from January 28th through at least the beginning of 06, if not later, are emails from Mrs. Arday and her husband saying, my mother opposes this. My mother, I should say Mrs. Lewis, her mother, has been put on notice that she has to stop this, and she has not done so.
Well, let's go back to the relief that was requested. Your client wanted specific performance of the contract and damages. Is that correct? Both.
Yes.
So, and as of now, what's the status of the development? Have you gotten all the approvals you need, or is the controversy ongoing?
As of now, amazingly enough, not one spade of dirt has been turned.
So
this is still before the HRB and the county.
All right, so then there is still an actual controversy, and your client still needs relief, either in the form of specific performance or monetary damages.
Yes, sir. And we would ask,
and the specific performance you're seeking is the cooperation clause, performance of that?
Well, at this point, I think it would be in the form of an affirmative injunction that the Ardays cannot speak on behalf of their mother. I mean, the Ardays have continued to speak.
Because of the cooperation clause. That in the cooperation clause, didn't that merge into the deed?
I don't believe it did. And I think the exchange that Ms. Arday had with the attorney prior to closing on the document, on the sale, makes it clear that it wasn't intended to. And
so
I believe Mr. McCollum's deposition.
That's a legal question for the Court of Chancery to resolve.
And the Court of Chancery did resolve it, I believe. He said, I don't accept that argument to Mr. Whitinger. And Mr. Whitinger, although he's in the unusual position of a cross appellee, hasn't appealed that, okay. nor did Mr. Finger.
So if we were to agree with your position that there was an issue of material fact regarding whether or not the Ardays were authorized to speak on behalf of Mrs. Lewis, did speak and were authorized to speak, then I suppose it would follow that it was error to grant summary judgment. There has to be a trial, and all of the SLAPP-related issues are premature until that trial is concluded and the court determines the merits finally. Is that correct?
I don't think the SLAPP issues get revived unless this court concludes that they're inappropriately resolved. I think the SLAPP issues...
They would be resolved, if at all, at the trial, wouldn't they? Because you would be contending at the trial. That the Ardays were, A, speaking for Mrs. Lewis, and, B, were authorized to do so. And the other side would say no, there was no authorization. They were speaking as private citizens who had the right to petition.
And I think, if you're asking me, do I think an issue of law would remain under the SLAPP Act because they could still conclude, I struggle with the question, but let me try to answer it this way. I think if this court remands and reverses and says a summary judgment on the contract issues was incorrect, then there is a good faith basis by virtue of your ruling that this was not a classic SLAPP litigation, and Mr. Nichols will be vindicated in having brought the action against Mrs. Lewis and against her agent. But I don't
necessarily... Well, that assumes a summary judgment standard, and hasn't your opponent cited cases that it's more than summary judgment?
He did cite them, and I think we addressed that in the papers, but I don't think the summary judgment standard adheres in that analysis.
Let's assume we disagree with your position and conclude that the Chancellor, Vice Chancellor, correctly granted summary judgment. What is your response to the argument that based upon the findings the Vice Chancellor made, at the very least there should be attorney's fees awarded based on the summary judgment record, that, or to put it differently, that the very findings that the court made mandate an award of attorney's fees under the SLAPP statute?
I would strongly disagree. I don't think the facts of this case align with the intent of the SLAPP Act at all. This is not, as you pointed out in the question, this is not a public person. That's why I made the point earlier. If you look at page 15 through 17 of our opening brief, there's a litany of quotes from the Ardaes emails. In almost every one, they link themselves to their mom or they declare Mrs. Lewis' intentions alone. They weren't speaking for themselves. They were speaking for their mother.
Well,
query whether the mother's ratification by silence.
The Court of Chancery didn't agree with you.
Well, the Court of Chancery said this was a very complicated issue, and I think inappropriately ruled at the summary judgment level that we were incorrect.
But if we find that he ruled appropriately, then what is your response to the argument that the very findings that were made as part of the grant of summary judgment to the Ardaes also entitled them as a matter of law to attorney's fees under the SLAPP statute?
And I come back, Your Honor, unfortunately and respectfully, to the notion that the question is, was this done in a good faith, in pursuit of a good faith extension of the law? And I think it is. Plainly, this is not the typical SLAPP situation. And if this were,
even if he was correct in granting summary judgment on your contract claim because there was no agency, notwithstanding his determination there was no basis to find an agency, nevertheless, your client had a good faith belief that there might have been an agency and did not bring a frivolous lawsuit.
And yes, sir, and I think that's supported by the record. And I apologize, I'm at a minute and 20, so if you have no, I may not want to stand yet again. I have 5 minutes reserved, so we'll see how that goes.
Thank you,
Your Honors.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court, Michael Weidinger on behalf of Joanne Lewis. And I would like to thank the Court for the extension of oral argument time to permit me to speak today. And I had planned to discuss two basic points. First, that their vice chancellor should be affirmed because there is because Susan Ardaes was not acting as Mrs. Lewis' agent for purposes of carrying out any obligation under the agreement. The sins of the daughter shouldn't be laid to rest at the door of the mother vis-a-vis this contract. Mr. Nichols filed this lawsuit, and he now on oral argument has suggested that he thinks that there was a fact issue with respect to the question of agency as it relates to the conduct, but his theory in his papers and his theory had devolved to one of failure of supervision. It wasn't really one of Mrs. Ardaes and Mrs. Lewis had gotten together and were acting in concert to oppose Mr. Nichols. And it wasn't a theory that Mrs. Ardaes was in fact acting as an authorized agent to oppose Mr. Nichols. It was a theory that Mrs. Lewis had some obligation or duty to supervise her daughter when she gave her daughter the authorization, as the court below found, and we don't contest, the authorization to provide information to Mr. McCollum or to carry information from Mr. McCollum to Mrs. Lewis when she was ill.
Mr. Weidinger, isn't that the failure to supervise just another way of articulating an apparent authority theory? That is,
I think that's probably correct.
The daughter was holding herself out as a fully authorized agent. The mother knew it, and the mother should have taken steps to make it clear that she wasn't.
Well, I think there's a couple of points. Yes, it is an apparent authority theory. Number two, apparent authority cannot arise by the conduct of the agent alone. So all of the statements that we have about Mrs. Ardaes and what she was sending, and there are a number of occasions, and it really occurs primarily in May and June of 2005, where she's sending some information to a woman by the name of Stephanie Bruning at the county planning office. And she sends these emails, and she's basically given updates in her point of view. And she does say in some of those emails, Mrs. Lewis has a certain point of view. She sent those. It's undisputed. But
those
are her manifestations. They were not a manifestation of Mrs. Lewis.
But when you see that, tell me why, with a record to that effect, it was appropriate to decide this case on summary judgment.
Because apparent authority, which is the theory that he's going by, requires a manifestation by the principal. This was all statements by Mrs. Arday, the alleged agent, to these third parties. And so you don't have a manifestation by Mrs. Lewis that Mrs. Arday was authorized to act on her behalf. We also don't have any evidence that's also required under apparent authority that somebody reasonably relied or acted upon that knowledge or information.
But do you agree that there was a letter sent to Mrs. Lewis that said you need to take corrective action?
There was a letter sent to Mrs. Lewis and threatened lawsuits that she needed to take corrective action. I believe it was in March of 05.
And did the representations or the invocation of Mrs. Lewis's name continue nevertheless?
They continued in May and in June, but that assumes that there's some ability on behalf of Mrs. Lewis to control statements that her daughter was making to the public.
Well, but wouldn't her ability or inability to control her daughter be something that would be developed in a record and not on summary judgment? How can we assume, as a matter of law, that she just had no ability to control her daughter at all, no knowledge of what her daughter was doing? It just is clear that that should just continue, and it was not Mrs. Lewis's fault.
Well, The record is clear with respect to what happened. The facts are undisputed, and I don't think it's a legal conclusion, I think, that the court below could draw and that this court could draw without any further development of factual record with respect to what happened. These emails went out, and the question is, what's the consequence?
There are differences that could be drawn from the facts, even if the facts are undisputed.
Well, I don't think there are different inferences that can be drawn with respect to whether or not she was an agent for purposes of carrying out any of the obligations under the contract.
Well, just to follow up on Justice Ridgely's question, the mother, through her attorney, gets a letter from the attorney for the brothers saying your daughter is out of control. You know, she's purports to be speaking in your behalf. You need to control your daughter. Now, what could have happened then, and some would argue should have happened, is that the attorney for Mrs. Lewis should have gotten authorization to write a letter to the attorney for the Arday saying cease and desist. And that may be all that Mrs. Lewis could and should have done, and, you know, with copies to everybody. But that wasn't done here. Now, it isn't the fact that it wasn't done, but could have been done. Wouldn't that generate an inference that Mrs. Lewis knew that her daughter was purporting to speak in her behalf and allowed her to continue to do so?
It supports a factually, let me step back and say that that's an accurate summary of what happened, in the sense that Mr. McCollum said in his deposition, in hindsight, maybe I should have done that. Maybe I should have sent that. But the question becomes whether or not that should be a liability inducing on the part of my client.
And going back to Justice Ridgely's question, wouldn't an inference be that what the daughter was saying was all right with Mrs. Lewis?
No, I think the appropriate inference the judge drew was that below, based on the record, was that Mrs. Arday was given limited authority to provide information to her mother, and she exceeded that authority, and that's the appropriate inference to be drawn based on this record, which has no evidence of Mrs. Lewis ever affirmatively to anybody expressing that her daughter was authorized to act with respect to these development plans. And critically, with respect to liability inducing activity, in my view, the critical point, I think, found by the Vice Chancellor below, and we seek to affirm, is that somebody had to act on that belief. Somebody had to think that Mrs. Ardaes was actually representing Mrs. Lewis, that Mrs. Lewis supported her conduct and her activities, but there's no such evidence. Nobody relied upon these statements by Mrs. Ardaes. The county planner, primarily responsible for this, and the 30B6 witness, didn't even know who the Ardaes were. There's no evidence that there was any influence of any of this conduct based on these statements. Therefore, in a question of apparent agency, it fails. But that same line of reasoning also leads to the same conclusion with respect to Mr. Nichols' inability to create a causal link for any harm that he suffered. He was unable to show, through a full opportunity to develop a record, that he suffered any harm caused by the Ardaes' conduct, as opposed to the fact that he just simply had a very complex project, which was 236 acres with a historic overlay, and people were interested in it and had questions and concerns.
Well, did he testify by affidavit or deposition that he was harmed?
He said he was harmed, but he couldn't identify what it was until at the 11th hour and after discovery, he threw in a rebuttal affidavit which said, there's been some six-month delays or so, and so I've had some interest payments.
So it's a matter of whether he's believed or not.
Well, no. He didn't provide any cognizable evidence with respect to that, and he's got no basis to say that, there's been delays caused by the Ardaes' conduct. He doesn't have any personal knowledge with respect to what the county was doing, and the county testified to the contrary. Finally, with respect to one argument that we've made as to why an injunction is inappropriate.
Your time is up, so we'll read that with what you filed.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Your Honor, just 2 points I'd like to focus on in the brief time I have. Mr. Bronkowski kept talking about the evidence showed that there was a good faith basis for his claim. Not to belabor the obvious, but that's not the standard under the statute. The standard is substantial basis, and as Justice Ridgely pointed out, we've cited cases to the court from other jurisdictions which suggest that substantial basis is a higher standard than simply satisfying a motion to dismiss or a motion for summary judgment. And in this case, the motion for summary judgment was not even satisfied. The other point is regarding, Your Honor, said questions about whether there were factual disputes requiring a remand to have a heavy trial. However, I respectfully suggest that if that is a genuine concern of the court, before remanding, I think the court needs to look at it in its de novo review of this appeal, whether notwithstanding these factual disputes, the law precludes recovery. A point that we have emphasized is that agents of any stripe are not responsible are not liable for the breaches by their principals, even if they are a participant in it. They owe no duty. So that destroys any issue of the Ardaes' liability.
Even as an aider and abettor?
That's true. Yes, Your Honor, because especially if you find them as the agent. Agents are deemed to be one with their principals. There can be no conspiracy between an agent and a principal under the law, and similarly, an aiding and abetting is simply another form of saying conspiracy. So if you give them what they want and say that they're agents, that's out.
You're saying that while Mrs. Lewis may still be in the case, your clients are not.
That's correct, Your Honor. So the legal – so the point I'm highlighting is that –
But there was no finding of conspiracy. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And they withdrew expressly any argument about collusion. So the Vice Chancellor did not address the legal arguments. He focused exclusively on the factual arguments. However, in this court's de novo review, if Your Honor is inclined to remand, it should look at the legal defense to see if it's a fruitless exercise. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
I would like to try to put to rest this issue of what my theory of the case has been. My theory of the case has always been very simple, that a principal who silently sits by while an agent takes conduct that the principal knows is not within the agency, ratifies the conduct of the agent, and is culpable for the agent's behavior. That has been our theory all along.
And what's your theory in response to Mr. Finger's argument that assuming you prevailed on the theory you articulated, there's no basis for liability against the agents individually?
I don't disagree with that. The agent and the principal are one. That was our point all along. When we first filed the case, the point was that Mrs. Lewis was in breach because of this conduct that was discussed in the instant teleconference in November of 05, maybe. But that I don't quarrel with that conclusion.
So there would be no award of damages or injunctive relief against Mr. Finger's client?
Not as agents breaching the contract. And that's how their role is in this case. Now, then you step out and go to the tortious interference count, where Mr. Arday, if he is not agent for his mother-in-law, is either sub-agent. It gets fairly attenuated. I don't disagree. But there wouldn't per se be a remedy against the Ardays in the contract case, which is what we're here for.
But there would as a matter of tort.
There could be as a matter of tort. Certainly.
So if it's remanded and you prevail on your claim that summary judgment shouldn't have been granted under the contract, we have the prospect of a trial where the Ardays are denying agency, and to the extent they can convince a court that they weren't agents, then your claim against the principal, Mrs. Lewis, is not going to go anywhere on a breach of contract unless you can show she did something directly.
I don't agree that it has to be shown directly. I think that's the whole the Geyer versus Havig case.
Well, then you'd have to show it through her agents. But that's why in my question
I'm
for
sorry.
You is you're going to be trying to establish agency.
Yes.
At the same time, Mr. Finger's clients are going to be denying they were agents at all.
Yes, sir. If I may, Your Honor, I put this in my brief.
But you're also out of time. So we'll take your other arguments on the papers that you've presented.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Well, the court appreciates the arguments from everyone. They've been very helpful.